I always start with when and where you were born.
I was born on April 12th, 1944, in Ruskin College, Oxford.
Well, yeah, that's a distinguished place to be born in.
It was my mother and father. I was their eldest child, their first child. They lived in a cottage, rented a cottage in Monks Risborough, outside Oxford. Only a cold running water tap and outside loo. And during the war, Ruskin College was turned into maternity facilities, I guess so people didn't have to go so far, far afield. And my mother used to tell me with a smile that when she went back with my father to a lecture at Ruskin, he was giving, a few years after my birth, she was actually sitting on the platform where she'd had her internal examination just prior to my delivery.
Well, not many people could beat that story to start off with. Many people like to trace their antecedents back a bit, sometimes to the Civil War or to the Anglo-Saxons, or often to their grandparents. And that's often a good point to start with. Did you know your grandparents?
I knew both sets of grandparents, and both sets of grandparents were Jewish immigrants, fleeing pogroms of world before at the time of World War I, so before Nazism and World War II. My mother's family, she would say, came from what was sometimes Latvia and sometimes Russia. Her father, who was a very dignified man, had fled frontline service. The Jews were put in into combat in World War I, and so they were migrants from that. I think lots of Russian stroke Latvian families were. Her older sister was born in Latvia, and she was born in London. So my mother was just British. Oh, by the way, my maternal grandfather was a furrier who made rabbit coats for CNA. My father's parents left Poland when he was two, and his father was a haberdasher and had import-export connections, I mean literally bought and sold, in Germany. So somewhat unwisely, they left Poland. His mother came from Warsaw and left Warsaw just before the ghetto. They lived in Łódź, and then they went to Germany. And from there, when he was rising 12, they came to London. So not very British, me.
Oh, well, after Cheltenham Ladies' College, everyone is
Oh yeah,
British.
absolutely. Retrained. I retrained.
Did you know them as people? I mean, as characters, were they?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I did. I'll start with, because I did before, with my mother's family. My mother's mother was rotund and 5 footish, spoke with a heavy accent. I remember nothing about her intellectually. I remember her cooking. I remember going into the kitchen where she would have sheets for pasta, noodles, sheets for noodles, hanging over the back of a kitchen chair in front of the fire. I remember her making all kinds of pastries, where she would explain to me that you never had to measure anything. She'd make a pile of flour in the middle of the table, and then she'd break the eggs into the top, and then she'd mix it all with her hands. So my first experience of inspired cooking was my maternal grandmother. My maternal grandfather, all the grandchildren found in annoying. He did that thing of pinching your cheek.
Oh,
He was a cheek pincher.
yes.
And incidentally, he and she tended to speak Yiddish. So I could understand Yiddish, but my mother also would answer in English. So the parental generation had extremely heavy Eastern European accents and mostly spoke Yiddish at home. But my mother and her siblings all spoke with, they lived in Sanford Hill, Stoke Newington as now is, and they all were Londoners. My father's parents, as I say, his father was a haberdasher, though I think he was a smuggler as well, but maybe the two were the same. He did a lot of travelling across, you know, the moving national boundaries, I know. Slightly romantic figure. He gave us watches. That's why we thought he was a smuggler, and probably it's true. We were all given watches as small children, which, given the state of finance of all of my grandparents, was highly unlikely. And my father used to shrug and say he wasn't quite sure where they'd come from. There was a very romantic story, actually, about how he pursued my grandmother, whose family had already moved to England, proposed to her, then taken her back to Poland, and then eventually they ended up again. But I'm not quite clear about that story. He had become ferociously religious by the time I remember him. So there was the number of times a day when we were told to be quiet because, as we all put it, Grandpa was mumbling. So he would do his prayers however many times a day, and he kept kosher. There was an extraordinary rift between my grandparents and my parents on both sides. Both sides of the family kept kosher, kept all the festivals, fasted on Yom Kippur, you know, put up tabernacles, all of that stuff. My parents did none of it. And we as children didn't notice that we would tend to go to our grandparents for some of the high holidays. So we learned our Jewish practice with our grandparents, although we didn't really notice it. And at my father's house, it was deeply undermined by my fantastic grandmother, who basically was mightily, roundly annoyed at this all of this religious practice and would subvert it wherever possible. So she couldn't be relied on to buy socks that were not of mixed cotton and nylon. She couldn't be relied on for anything. And she used to hide our Easter eggs in this kosher household in a drawer in her bedroom. Now, she was a remarkable character. And, you know, in publicly, quite often when I speak, I salute my paternal grandmother. She was a woman of fierce intelligence, angry beyond belief at a life wasted. But she was a member of the Communist Party, a very active member of the Communist Party. And in my early career, I would know if I were anywhere and somebody said, "So you're Mrs. B's granddaughter," that they were communists. She was Mrs. B in London communist circles. She was an early member of the London County Council. She had a sort of radical salon at home when I assume Grandpa was banished to shul, you know. My mother remembers that she had a small clay print hanging in the hall, and that was my mother became an artist, and she was an art student when she met my father, and that was a vivid memory for her. She didn't get on with my grandmother at all. They were both competing for my father's love, but progressive radical thought was there with my grandmother. I was a bit terrified of her, but as you can see, she taught me a lot. She also taught me a lot about cooking. She poured all her creativity. She was an even better cook than my maternal, in fact, a lot better cook than my more complicated cook. She taught me to whip egg whites on a flat plate with a fork, which you have to do using centrifugal force. You have to beat it so hard it doesn't fall off the plate. That was one of her skills, her tricks. And she taught me to value myself intellectually. I could see how clever she was, and she, though I don't remember it, must have brought that out in me.
Lovely portrait. Moving on to the next generation, your parents, tell me something about them.
Well, oddly, I've learned a little more about my father's youth, about which I knew virtually nothing.
You better say who he was.
So my father was Jacob Bronowski, mathematician, scientific populariser, best remembered in Britain for a 12-part TV series, The Ascent of Man, but actually for older people, from the Brain's Trust. He was a resolute believer that there is nothing so difficult that a person in the street can't understand it as long as you don't let them know it's difficult. And that is a mantra that I have stuck to all my life as well, but he taught me that. As I say, he came to England at 12, told the story. Now, the stories of his boyhood I knew from him and are recorded of how he had, he learned three words of English on the boat coming over. He was tipped into Central Foundation School for Boys, where he struggled with the language, went to Whitechapel Library, which alas is no more, took out Midshipmanesian, Masterman Ready, and learned his English entirely from there, and became a mathematician, as many immigrant children do, because there he wasn't disadvantaged by his difficulty with the language, and gained a scholarship to Cambridge. Now, all I then knew about his life from then until he met my mother in his 30s, was two letters that, as a fellow of Jesus, when I was a fellow of Jesus, I was entitled to look at in his file, though fascinatingly that file appears subsequently to have disappeared. And the first letter was a letter from my grandmother, that I truly hope has not disappeared, to the senior tutor, which started out, "Dear sir, I know it is unseemly of me to write, but my husband is away on business." Of course, he wasn't. He was down the road praying. and it was her saying that my father was given a pauper's scholarship, there was no way he could come up. Wonderful three-page letter. And he was indeed given a pauper's scholarship. The other, 3 years later, was a letter from Quilla Cooch to the then senior tutor, saying, "Mr. Bronowski is minded to apply for a fellowship in this college. He has as much chance of a fellowship as of becoming Archbishop of Canterbury." So that was what I knew. But my daughter Rachel was researching this spring a television programme she was producing and directing on Alastair Cook, of Letter to America fame. And they were exact contemporaries. And suddenly a whole lot of material was unearthed relating to the two of them in their university days, which revealed to me the first time how difficult it must have been for my father at Cambridge. And the thing that showed me that difficulty with greatest clarity was a photograph that Jesus College found of the editorial board of Granter magazine, all in their tweed jackets, this was in 1930, whatever, in tweed jackets on the lawn, and in the back row was Alastair Cook, working class boy from Blackpool, 6 foot, elegant, brilliantined quiff, dashing. And next to him was my father, working class Jewish immigrant boy, 5'1", with kinky black hair, a complexion that was very, very much darker at that time in his life than as he aged, as happens to all of us, and so Eastern European, and rather curiously flamboyantly dressed, that it sort of screamed at me how ill at ease he was in that environment. And fortuitously, at about the same moment, an old friend of mine in Cambridge, who was clearing out her father's possessions, and we neither of us still understand this connection, unearthed a whole cache of 50 or 60 letters from my father, from university, to this older man. who lived in London near them at the time and was another communist. My father's letters about what it felt like to be at Cambridge, which confirmed a sense that I've been just thinking about recently in relation to Raymond Williams, because he has, writes about it so clearly, the sense of encountering disadvantage and inequality in that Cambridge environment. So I think I began to empathise for the first time what a struggle it was to be. He never spoke about it, never, ever, ever. He never spoke about his life as anything other than easy. And I think that was a great liberation for me. I never had to carry any of that guilt that some of our first generation students, university students, carry at the University of London, who are of other ethnicities, the guilt about the disadvantage of their parents that they carry with them. My parents never spoke about it, but I have now sort of revisited it.
Fascinating. Since we're on Jacob Bronowski, tell me a little more about how he intellectually or emotionally influenced you, having such a famous father.
If I'd been a boy, it would probably have ruined my life. And I have to tell you, if he'd had a boy, it might have ruined my life. but I was the eldest of four girls, and I was his son. To the extent that when he died, his mistresses annoyingly wrote to me in terms that I don't believe you should write to a daughter. Hmm. I certainly didn't reply. He exerted an influence over me which any psychoanalyst would say was disastrous, you know. But I don't hold with psychoanalysis. He treated me like an equal from the minute that I can remember. I mean, almost the first thing I can remember, and I probably was, what, four, I was playing chess with him. In this household full of women, he sort of pulled me out and groomed me to be his son. In fact, I mean, and to show you that that's not an exaggeration, I remember him very clearly teaching me to run like a boy. He said that he said girls ran in this ridiculous way, letting their arms flap, and that he wasn't the least bit sporty, but I was not to run like a girl. Right? So I've always been very proud of running like a boy. let me just say a little more about that. Yes, so by the time I was, at least by the age of seven, I was playing a good game of chess against him, a skill I have subsequently lost. And he discovered very quickly that I was hardwired for maths. So, you know, we had a little sort of secret game of maths problems. And that probably wasn't very good for me either. So I was very precocious, very precocious. And probably a slightly lonely, you know, this was, you know, late 40s, early 50s. I mean, I never once thought that there was anything intellectually different about being a girl. Never. So, you know, I owe that totally to my father. And I despised my mother. I say that on camera.
Yes, I've said it.
I've explained.
You've said it before.
Until I had my own children, I thought my mother was a nuisance. She was this arty person. I mean, you know, and I imbibed the art, I absorbed the art, I learned to paint, I learned to do complicated knitting, I learned to cook, I learned all those things, all skills I did not value. I didn't think she had any skills. And it was annoying that you had to break off the math problems to have a normal conversation with my mother. And I do remember her once slapping my face, and I'm sure I deserved it, at about 11. At 10 and a half, I won an exhibition to Cheltenham Ladies' College. Now, that's also my father's influence, if you like. I passed the 11 plus with flying colours, and the uniform was bought for me to go to Pate's Girls' Grammar School in Cheltenham. And sometime at the very beginning, before term started, my father must have gone and visited. I don't think I visited. I may have done, but I don't think so. I think he probably went alone. And he came back and announced that they had no maths department. And so there was an absolute scramble at my primary school, and I remember my class form teacher at primary school conveying to me, very unprofessionally, how furious she was that I was to be put in for the scholarship exam for Cheltenham, and she therefore was not going to lift a finger, and she thought it was outrageous and wrong for me. You know, she could have been right. So I went into this scholarship exam totally unprepared. I mean, laughably unprepared. And I wrote an essay on smells, which I misunderstood. So I wrote about the smells I hated most. It was supposed to be the smells. So that must have seemed quite eccentric. I was violently car sick all through my childhood. So I wrote about oil and petrol fumes. And then when they interviewed me, I remember them laughing over my head about the fact that these were my favourite smells. And only at that point did I realise it was supposed to be your favourite smells. But more importantly, I couldn't do any of the questions on the maths paper, except there was a question. You see how these things are burned in on your memory. There was a question in which you had to calculate the area of a grass border round a swimming pool. And I hadn't done areas, but I worked it out from first principles. So I spent the whole exam doing this one question, and they gave me an exhibition.
Very clever of them, perceptive of them.
Yes, it was.
Excellent. Well, let's go back. Just on your mother and despising her, was she anti-intellectual?
Oh, absolutely not. She was pro, and she's 91. She's still alive. She was exactly the right partner for him. Mm. I may have got some of it from my grandmother. My paternal grandmother never forgave her. Mm. Never forgave her that her son had married a flibbertigibbet of an art student rather than a great intellectual. Mm. His previous girlfriend, live-in partner, had been Arliss Roberts, who founded the Consumer Association, with whom he had a miserably adversarial. I mean, you know, they were throwing crockery at each other, couple, and my grandmother felt that was a much better match.
Let's go back to your childhood again. In the formative years between sort of chess at four and doing 11 plus. Do you remember any, you must remember quite a lot about that, were there any hobbies or things you were passionately interested in?
Well, you know, this was a Jewish immigrant family. I mean, we were passionately interested in everything, and anything we showed the slightest interest in, we were projected at, right? God knows where they found the money. One bit of enormous good fortune for me was that when I was three, I think, we'd have to get the date right, somewhere around then, my father and Julian Huxley were part of the founding group at UNESCO in Paris, and we went and lived in Paris for 6 months. And I learned some French, which I seemed to hold with me, and when I started French again, I found it very easy, and I now count myself fluent in French. Some people say I'm bilingual. I'm not really bilingual, but I am absolutely fluent in French, and that started then. My mother loved the guitar, and from halfway through primary school, I learned the classical guitar, which is a very weird bohemian thing to do in those days. Segovia was at his height. Julian Bream was knee-high to a grasshopper. John Williams, I actually once beat in a guitar competition when, you know, he was whatever, and he was 2 years older than me. So I learned the classical guitar. So I got a musical education outside school that also stood me in good stead. And I would have to say that I have a singing voice, and Cheltenham really, really trained that.
Let's go on with the music a little bit. I mean, how important has music been, either in relation to your general life or to work or to your interests?
Well, you see, I've said and I've written that there was no distinction between any of the arts and science in our family. And so that you would go off to take the soprano part in a small group, madrigal, grubora, or a small choir in a chapel. And they, incidentally, my parents didn't mind where I went or what I did doctrinally. That was just part of the fact that my mother painted, my mother sculpted, that there were painters and sculptors in and out of the house. I would have to say there was no music in our home, which was quite interesting, like there were no pets. I have thought back on that, and I think that may have to do with those itinerant families. They didn't listen. We didn't have the radio on. You know, my husband is from a working class family, and he requires a radio in every room. And as you move from room to room, you turn the radio on and listen to the, you know, voice radio, talk radio. There wasn't any of that. It was a silent household. My father was mad about Lotte Lenyer and Brecht and Kurt Weill, and my mother was mad about Juliette Gréco and Edith Piaf. So when there was music on, it was that, and that would be in, sort of in the evening. There was no orchestral music, there was no symphonic music, there was no chamber music at all, at all, at all. All of that I got at school.
And has it been very important?
Incredibly important. I might not have survived Cambridge without the Labour Club on one side and the music on the other. They were the two, I mean, like some people had, I didn't do drama, I did do enormous amounts of music. I didn't play the guitar, by the way. I stopped playing the guitar when I came up. For the first year, I studied the lute. I thought maybe I'd, you know, do something interestingly historical. And then somehow, thing is, I didn't like solo music. And having been taught a solo instrument, you know, I very much wished I'd had an orchestral instrument. And my daughter, Rachel, is a pretty damn good trumpeter. And I love the fact that now she's a TV producer, but twice a week she's off in some scratch band or other playing the trumpet.
A lovely thought. I often ask about music and creativity. Mm. I mean, some people find, like Simon Chaffer always has to be listening to quite loud music when he's writing. Mm. Other people can't bear it anywhere. They just have to listen or not. But does it have any direct relationship with your work?
No, I don't write listening to music. I don't care what noise is going on. I'm impervious to noise. In fact, the thing is, I'm impervious to sound when I'm writing. Mm. That was the thing my father taught me. He never had a study. He wrote every word he ever wrote sitting at the kitchen table with four delinquent girls careering around him and all of their friends and anybody who came into the house. And I remember when I took my, whatever they were called then, GCEs or whatever they were called then, at Cheltenham, some girl putting up her hand in tears and saying she couldn't work because there was a drill outside the window and being completely flabbergasted that anybody who was working on an exam could possibly hear anything outside the window. So that's probably why I don't listen. There was a period in my life, I became a rather posy graduate student at Cambridge, fell in with poets and musicians, and I used to listen to orchestral music then. I lived alone then, I was writing my PhD, so I think that's comprehensible. But now, for instance, I simply do it wherever I am, and I can write almost anywhere. And I can shut out anything.
Do you think that, well, it's difficult for you to say, but I notice you've written a lot of books.
Yes.
High productivity, is that partly because you can just switch on and write and then...
No, my high productivity is because I'm a woman, right? I was not highly productive until the last
until you became a woman, right?
Until the last of my three children left home.
Ah, right.
Not left home, left school.
Yeah.
I was a serial mother, so I had three children between 1970 and 1984. Last was born in 1984. So I realised in 1994, when Sam was 12, and therefore independent, that 25 years continuous mothering, fitting in anything I did around pairing socks at 7 in the morning and remembering to get the washing out of the washing machine and make the packed lunches and collect one child from music lesson and so on. And if you look at my career, that's when my productivity takes off. Suddenly, there was acres of time. And I was so disciplined as to how to use time that I've just gone on being disciplined using time. I am very disciplined with time.
Very interesting. I'll have to study other women and see where
this... I do, actually, I'm not being entirely facetious. I do actually think you will see that is quite common.
That's very interesting. Let's go back to Cheltenham Ladies' College then. Did you enjoy it there?
I was a day girl because we lived in Cheltenham, because my father was working for an experimental research lab for the Coal Board just outside Cheltenham. So I was a day girl from rising 11. I must be just 11. Yes, just 11. Until 15. And then my parents moved to London, and then I became a boarder. And I definitely hated boarding. If you think of the family milieu I came out of, I'll just take that bit first and then go back to the little one. My first week boarding, I discovered that Goy girls washed a lot. We had to get into this cubicle every night with a curtain round it and wash, and then we had to get in and wash every morning. Now, in the sort of family I came from, you bathed at the weekend. my husband would tell you I'm still not very good at washing, but there were just these cultural patterns that made me completely miserable. And that's just the one I remember most obviously. The food was wrong, the everything, it was just... And it was so taken for granted. I mean, everybody else, even, my friend Darshana Bogalal from Delhi, they all knew how to do it. They'd all done it at boarding school since they were 11. I was really thrown by it. At the same time, the interesting thing is that as a nubile adolescent, that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, to be locked up while I was doing my A-levels, right? Mm. But going back to being a day girl, I loved the teaching. There was a class, so the first year was called Year 6, and there was 6A, B, C, D, and 6X. 6X was the real SWAT girls, and I was in the X stream all the way up. I mean, none of this mixed ability then. And we were just... I've only seen teaching like that once since then, and that was when my youngest sister, Claire, who's 11 years younger than me, when my parents went to America, she was put into a gifted children program in California because they didn't know what hit them with this. English 7-year, precocious, again, 7, not 8-year-old. And Mr. B, who taught her, that it was that same sort of teaching. It was unbelievable. What I learned, and particularly for a girl in the 50s, was absolutely extraordinary. But I wouldn't say I was happy. Mm. I loathed the sport.
Even though you could run as a boy, or perhaps because you could run as a boy.
I don't know what it was. I mean, I hadn't grown up with organised sport. I loathed it. None of us could swim, right? Because nobody, my parents came from inland, nobody swam, neither of them could swim. Going to the swimming baths in my terrible green swimming costume, and being the only one in the class who couldn't swim, it was all like that. So I've got this real schizophrenic relationship with it. I owe everything that I now have intellectually to that school. There's absolutely, of course my family, training terms, I owe absolutely everything to that school, which was, as you're hearing, a highly intellectual school. Miss Treadgold, who was the principal, had a first in maths, and nobody who taught me maths, and they're all women, had come out of mostly Oxford, I think she was Oxford too, with less than a first. Hmm.
Do you remember any particular teachers who, either there or at the previous school, particularly affected? Or were they all very good?
No. Teachers all liked me, and you know, usually when people have a favourite teacher, it's because they found a teacher who likes them. But if you have a child who can just do it, you know, who you can push as hard as you like, and is biddable and focused, and I can remember, there's a whole sequence of teachers, but maybe Miss Shaw, who taught me applied maths at Cheltenham, but not with particular affection. The first teacher, and as it were teacher, with whom I had that bond, is a man I saw only last night, called Bertie Bellis, who was the head of maths at Highgate School in London. And when we'd moved to London, and I had, as we will come to in a second, somehow blown my A-levels, he coached me when I had completely lost confidence. And without him, I don't know what would have happened to me. And I wouldn't say I've kept in touch with him, I haven't, but I wrote about him as the most important teacher in my life about 10 or 15 years ago, and his wife wrote to me and said, you know, he is still alive. and I've actually seen him regularly ever since.
And he came to your lecture, did he?
Yes, he did.
That's nice. So how did you... Should we get on to the blowing of the A-level?
Yes, yeah, so I've actually seen it happen to two of my own children. If you find academic work easy, you're not prepared for when it stops being easy. So most children, normal children, I'm not saying abnormal, normal children struggle with some subject and learn strategies for dealing with difficulty. Children who are ahead in their schoolwork, well, certainly me, I don't remember ever thinking about tests or exams or learning in any subject until after GCE, when, you know, we all got 10 A's or something. Yeah. We didn't actually, they weren't so vulgar as to put us in for 10, you know, I think we took 8 or something. And we all had to get over 90 for Latin, because that, you know, there wouldn't be... Mm. I mean, of course Cheltenham girls got 90 for Latin. Mary Whedon, later Mary Archer, was in my class. She got 92 for chemistry. That was pretty good.
Mary Archer.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. So I then started on my A-level work, and I couldn't do it. No, you know, why couldn't I do it? I could do it, but I couldn't do it fast. I could no longer do it easily, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And somebody should probably have spotted it, but they were so used to me being the brain box, and nobody did. And I would say, and this is the only thing I would say against my father in this process, I think he came to rely on the school. He stopped paying attention. He had paid very close attention to my education until I got well into the math stream at Cheltenham, and then he just let me do it. Now, probably it will turn out it was a period in his life when he was terribly busy. Nobody noticed. And I took my A-levels in, we only took 3, pure and applied maths and physics. I blew them, I got Bs. In the days when that really meant something, right? Maybe I got ABB, you know. But in terms of going into the university entrance stream, that was a bit of a disaster. Yes, that's right. Maybe I got AAB. Do you know? I can't remember. No. But anyway, that was warning one. And then I took university entrance, which was then a separate exam, the following term, and failed to get into Cambridge. Laughably got a place at St. Hugh's College, Oxford. My father said that Oxford really wasn't any good for maths, so I'd have to try again. And by this time, I was actually a gibbering wreck, right? Which, again, nobody quite seemed to have noticed. Because I was keeping up the pretense.
Yeah, exactly. I was saying it would be probably difficult to judge you were a gibbering wreck.
Yes. So. And that also happened to my youngest son quite recently. We're very good at keeping up appearances. So I left school with everybody wringing their hands and my final reports all saying that they didn't know what could have happened, and it was, you know, it was a complete mystery. And then Bertie Bellis took me on, and Bertie just rebuilt me. And he's a very shy, quiet man. His wife told me quite recently, I was supposed to take classes at Highgate. But apparently, Joan Bellis, who's a very severe Methodist, very good woman who rules Bertie with a rod of iron, invited me round for tea. And apparently after I'd gone, told Bertie there were under no circumstances could I be allowed in to distract the boys. So I had one-on-one teaching in her living room with her pottering around in the background. So, you know, I worked with him, took my A-levels again, just took the maths. I must have got A in chemistry, in physics the first time round. That's right, and got, you know, A stars in pure applied maths and sailed into Newnham.
Into Newnham, yeah. Let's just go back to that sort of period, because that's often the period when people go through some religious crisis or whatever. You said your parents were not practicing Jews. Have you ever moved away from their position to any other position?
No.
How would you describe yourself? Okay,
well, believe it or not, you will believe it. When I got my exhibition to Cheltenham, which is a Church of England foundation, I had to go in on the Jewish quota. So, and there were 800 girls in the school, and there were 8 Jews. There were 8 Catholics too. and what that meant was that when I became a boarder, when they went to chapel, I had Hebrew lessons with a wonderful man called Dr. Naki Doniak. So rather wonderfully, most of my religious education I owe to Cheltenham Ladies' College. I received no religious training of any sort from my family, but because of this position at Cheltenham, I received a full Jewish training and the ability to read classical Hebrew from Cheltenham Ladies' College on Sundays. I did, therefore, in that period, fully fast on one Day of Atonement at Cheltenham in that period when I was boarding. And that's the closest I've ever come to religious practice. And so you are sort of slightly shielded if you come from an Eastern European Jewish home, because there are a lot of rituals, family rituals, that are others might construe as religious, but they're family rituals, you know. So with my children, we've lit Hanukkah candles, but you know, it's entirely comparable with having a Christmas tree. It's at that level. No, we're a secular family, although all of my children have had to, one way or another, because of comprehensive regulations, you know, local authority regulations, they've all had to declare themselves as Jews, and all got really cross with me about it, actually, to tell you the truth. You know, it was annoying, because they weren't anything different, that was their version, you know. It's like having to declare you were Welsh.
two of the recent people I've interviewed, Simon Schaffer and Paul Rabinow, are both Jewish, and they both the same sort of secular Jew as yourself, but they both had a feeling, particularly Simon, of this having affected their attitude to life quite deeply, being Jewish, in the sense of being, as Simon, just paraphrasing, being of the world, or in the world, but not of the world. Basically, always feeling completely comfortable and happy and integrated at one level, socially, but also always feeling a stranger, or not exactly a stranger, but outside and watching things as if he was not entirely... So he's sort of half playing the game, but not entirely.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's a trope that all Jews adopt.
Is it?
To the extent that I'm beginning to query it.
Right.
You're an anthropologist.
Yes,
you know, if all of your informants start giving you the same story, you begin to wonder about the story.
Yes.
I am just beginning to wonder. I would have said that to you if you hadn't said to me that Simon Schaffer had said it to you. I mean, I'm serious. Mm. I think there's a lot of... submerged confusion in our generation. Partly because many of us were not even told we were Jewish until we were 11 or 12. I mean, this was the period immediately after the war when everybody was pretending it hadn't happened. Absolutely pretending. And it would be absolutely impossible for anybody living in today's world to believe that the first time I saw footage of Auschwitz or Belsen at liberation, I was 20. It was considered something you were not going to show. And my mother always told us she had felt discriminated against, and we would all turn on her and say, "Don't be so ridiculous, we've never been discriminated against." And that there are all these confusions, you see what I mean? I mean, you know, our skin colour wasn't quite right, but we passed. You know, people would say, "Oh, you've got a suntan." People would always say to me, "You've got a suntan." "I have not got a suntan, I am this colour, right?"
Is that what you said to them?
it's sort of impolite, you know. But it's very funny. I mean, to have gone through your whole life being told you've got a suntan. Which is a way of saying you've been accepted, do you see what you know? And it is true, and I was talking to somebody about this just last night. It is true that we escaped the class system in some way. I was very shocked when I was at Cambridge and very active in the Labour Club at the burden of class consciousness that standard British students carried with them, either because they were middle class or because they were working class. And their ability to feel picked on or, you know, that something had happened because of, I found bewildering. And I did know I didn't have that, absolutely didn't have that. And they would tell me I was middle class and I'd laugh. It's sort of ludicrous to try and pigeonhole me. I knew they couldn't. And we are amazing chameleons. And actually, that's right, it was somebody who's working class Irish and had come in from Ireland, but he said the same about them. That if you come in from elsewhere, you can be a chameleon. If that's what you want to do, and your skin is not obviously other, you can be a chameleon. So I think I've always been a chameleon. I also think you have an extraordinary luxury, which is you can... throughout your life, you can choose to belong or not. Now, that's a luxury that you only have if you have two personae. I think you have that, and I think that makes us show-offs and extroverts, and might not always be a good thing, but I think that does happen.
Just to go on one further thing on choosing to belong or not to belong.
Yeah.
I mean, it always struck me as a central feature of Ernest Gellner that he, in a sense, had that choice, but that led to some of his difficulties because he both wanted to belong and not to belong at the same time. Socially, emotionally, he wanted to belong to the club, but always he felt intellectually that this would imprison him. So he had to...
How old is Gellner?
Well, he died in 95.
Yes, you see,
I mean, 70 then.
I'm just trying to think about it.
1925.
See, my father belonging to that wanting to belong generation. Mm. And I think we were saved from that somehow. Mm. There are lots of things I've wanted to belong to. Mm. Most of them I felt excluded. No, maybe that's a better answer. Most of the things I have felt excluded from, most of the things I've wanted to belong to, I have felt excluded from, have been because of my gender, not because of my faith. I've had enough of those to deal with, not to have noticed if maybe the Jewishness, you know, it's a bit as if I was a woman with a wooden leg. I mean, I would probably not notice if occasionally I was discriminated against for my wooden leg.
That's a nice answer, yeah. You came, as you mentioned, you come from a family where the arts and the sciences were not separate at all. What about religion and science? With all this discussion going on about the Dawkins approach to science disproving religion and so on, what is your feeling about the boundaries between those two and the oppositions between them?
I read The God Delusion and thought, so what? You know, I mean, what's all the fuss about? Enormous numbers of people in enormous numbers of cultures live their lives occasionally claiming that they do belong to a religion, but most of the time behaving as if they didn't, and probably most of the time not believing. And the number of clerics that I've met who have told me quite firmly they don't believe is quite astonishing. In fact, in the Church of England, it's almost a defining feature of the cloth. So I think, I mean, I find it annoying. I find the Dawkins argument annoying. I think it's polarizing people when completely unnecessarily. I think all of the worst things that have happened over the last many centuries have happened in the name of religion, but that doesn't mean that I particularly want to come down on people who find it comforting or useful or rescues them from something else. And I've always felt that Richard Dawkins has such an ahistorical and acultural mind. I mean, you know, there are, you know, you only have to go to the sort of places you've done your field work to know that. Well, I was in Marrakesh last weekend. As we drove on a bus towards the Atlas Mountains, everywhere I looked out, there were women sitting in a field with a cow. And I said to John, you know, it's so hard for me to think of a life where I would get up, make the family meal, take the cow down to the field and sit, wait till the end of the day, bring the cow back, deal with all the other stuff of the family, go to bed and then start it again. Now, I think if I did that, I might want religion.
that would drive you there. Good. We've just got a little more space for one more event in your life. Mm. Let's take you to Jesus College, Cambridge, which you went to do mathematics at.
Newnham College.
Newnham. Yes. You were a fellow at Jesus weren't you? Yes, yes, yes. What was it like being in a all-women college at that time?
Well, you now get my little rant about arriving in Newnham College, and this can be corroborated by my supervision partner, Esther Saraga, who I also seen again recently. We went in for our first supervision with a woman, bless her, who's gone, called Sheila Edmonds, who was in charge of maths at Newnham, and who herself, of course, had no degree, because women didn't take degrees until, whatever it was, 48, I think, 44 or 48. Mm. So that was kind of interesting that I went up in 63, and here was a mature woman already labouring under the inferiority complex of not having a degree. Now, I didn't know this at that point, but she sat us down, and she took us through what we were going to do. I think we were doing analysis in our first supervision, and then she said, of course, we'll try and send you to some male teachers next term because women just aren't as good at maths as men. And I literally went out of that supervision and I went to the payphone and I phoned my father and I said, is that true? That was the first time in my whole life I had heard that said. Because, of course, I'd moved seamlessly through girls' school and Bertie Bellis never said that to me. Shocking thing to have happened. And I never forgave her, you know.
What did your father say? Rubbish?
He said rubbish, but the damage was done. Mm. And then the whole demeanour of the math side at Newnham was a failure, right? And so my math got worse and worse again. I mean, I could do it, but I was hating it. I was incredibly active in Labour Party politics, as was Esther. Mm. So we would sort of scramble our... Esther's brother, Peter, was a stalwart of the Labour Club, and so we went along, and it became very active. Raymond Williams was very active around us. It was an incredible period for politics. We'd go into supervisions, and it was as if all of this politics outside wasn't there. It was the most extraordinary disjunction. And when I did very badly in my second year exams, or badly, it's like the bees, you know, I told my father I was quitting. I couldn't do any more of it. I mean, told him, of course, first. Mm. And there was a whole sort of crisis, and I said I wanted to change to English, because that was where Raymond Williams was. And I actually, in my Tanner lecture yesterday, said, you know, that was the mood of the moment. People changed to English because of their radical politics. Seems very strange. And so I changed to English at the end of my second year, absolutely over the dead body of Ruth Cohen, the principal. But I did.
What was the name of the principal? Ruth?
Ruth Cohen. She was an economist. Hmm.
And over the body of your father as well?
No, he was completely happy. Hmm. In fact, he said, I don't know why you came up to do English, do maths. He said, I'm afraid it might have been to please me. That isn't true, but there must have been something of that. Hmm.
The Labour Party, Labour politics, as you mentioned, was very important.
Yes.
Was it just within the Labour Club, or were you involved in the union, or any of
that? I wasn't. The union was, you know, posh people then. Mm. I mean, actually, one of the women in the Labour Club did infiltrate the union, and she did, in fact, become Sheena Matheson. She did become president of the union, a northern girl who. But
not,
you had
not
to place,
Anna Stafford Lock.
Well, before her, yes. Mm. She may have been the only woman before Anna, but she Arianna. But she. We stuck with, and you know, it was really serious. I mean, parliamentarians would come up and speak to us. I mean, I met every front, you know, where were we? Oh, we were just before Labour won, and you know, and then I had the thrill of fighting an election, you know, that we won.
In Cambridge.
In Cambridge. Well, and that, you know, and there was Labour government, and we won locally, and it was just heady, you know, and there was the Vietnam War, and it was. And basically, it was brilliant, and probably any subject I was studying would have suffered alongside. It was the, you know, it just formed me politically, and I hope, and actually I think on the strength of the last 2 days and giving the Tanner lectures on Raymond Williams and the legacy of culture and society in 2008, I think I can say to you, you know what? One thing I discovered was that I had remained true to the values of that. I am still true to those. I haven't changed. And that's why you find me in a very good mood today. It's quite nice to discover that.
You mentioned even as an undergraduate that you came across Raymond Williams. Did you come across him personally at that time?
Yes, yes. In the Labour Club. He was, it was a... the Labour Club, it wasn't like, you know, clubs then were really quite serious. I guess after the war, with returning National Service men, they'd become very important and they stayed that way. Mm. And so, when I had to organise lectures, talks, you know, you could write to the House of Commons and get absolutely anybody to come and talk. I remember having a... unbelievably drunk George Brown, or rather, we let him get unbelievably drunk because we were too inexperienced to know, having to sort of help him totter on and off the platform, and that's when I met Shirley Williams and various other people. And Raymond was, you know, there. And he was there. He wasn't there because he was never anywhere. But, I mean, he was never involved in anything. But he would take a petition for us or lead a march. Or he would come and do the right radical thing. Mm. I mean, David Hare, the playwright, writes about having been an undergraduate at Jesus and gets very cross about the fact they never saw Raymond. Well, if you were in politics, you did see Raymond.
Mm. Why has he been so important for you? I know you gave the town a lecture partly about this, but...
Yes, well, Culture and Society came out in 1958, 50 years ago this year. And then the Long Revolution, which was its strong arm political sequel, came out in 61. And so I came up in 63. And so this was it was about inequality in culture. Mm. And I mean, it was the 60s. We were all looking for change, and we were looking for ways of theorizing the social change that we wanted without knowing what the hell it was we did want. And Raymond's is a very, very attractive formulation, which basically says, I mean, he was a Marxist, but it's really a very Goldman, I mean, it's definitely, it's not classic Marxism, because it's not about the means of production, it's about the cultural superstructure, and it, but it's a theory of how you can use the analysis of culture both to understand your own relationship to class and to critique the status quo and move beyond it. I mean, nothing nicer than to be told that you should study Canon Arnold and Coleridge and produce political change. So we all did.
This was particularly because the two things came together in your third year when you did English, I suppose.
That, yes, and you know, people say, why did you change to English? Because Ruth Cohen wanted me to change to, the principal wanted me to change to economics.
Mm.
And my partner, supervision partner, Etty Saraga, changed to psychology. Mm. Well, no, she finished maths. She did finish, and then she changed to psychology. But the people in the Labour Club who saw more, you know, who were attuned to Raymond, were doing English. And in fact, what happened was I edited an issue of Labour magazine called Cambridge Forward with my friend Gavin. And we did an interview with Raymond for that. And Gavin was already reading English. And he said, you should be reading English. And that was the kind of...
When you say he said, was that Gavin or...
Gavin.
Or Raymond?
Not Raymond.
Gavin.
He wasn't a boyfriend, he was just a colleague.
Mm.
In fact, I think at Cambridge everyone thought I was gay, which suited me fine. I didn't actually know what gay was then.
Since I filmed your Tana lecture, and there's a lot about Raymond in that, and I'll hopefully put it up as a companion piece to this.
Oh, fantastic, because I was very happy with... I haven't done... Because I've been doing a lot of political work, I mean, you know, other work, and it's a while since I've sat down and reflected and produced absolutely original theoretical work, which still retains, I think, its politics.
Mm.
And I loved doing it, and I'm really happy with the way it came out.
Mm. Well, I've got that, so
great.
I'll just skim over Raymond, because you gave quite a lot about him there. At the end of your undergraduate time, what were the options that lay before you, and what did you take?
Well, I wanted to do a PhD, and now I wanted to do a PhD in what would now be called intellectual history. I mean, it was, you know, English was so in flux, and I had done, the papers I'd taken were a paper on what were quaintly called the English moralist, which was philosophy. A paper on tragedy, which was again theoretical and very heavily shaped by Raymond Williams. A paper on Jonathan Swift, which was entirely political, and then practical criticism. I wanted to do a sort of intellectual PhD and was told by Newnham that I could not. I'd only done 1 year of English, I could not possibly do a PhD in spite of my result. And so I went to Essex to do a master's for a year. I'm amazed that I was so obedient. I mean, now when I look at it, they had absolutely no right. I had perfectly good credentials to go on. I went, and so right at the beginning of Essex as a university, in its most radical days, bless them, I went and did a master's with Dennis Donoghue in literary translation at the University of Essex, and that was a fabulous year. That was the year of the Troubles and the sit-ins and agitprop, and if you wanted to live through the 60s, a year at Essex was no bad thing.
But you didn't want to stay on there.
I always wanted to go back to Cambridge. I mean, John Barrell was at Essex. It was amazing, actually. It was an amazing place. But I'd set my heart on coming back to Cambridge. So I came back to Cambridge the year after and started a PhD on translations of the Bible. The King James translation of the Bible.
Gosh.
With then Dr. Derek Brewer.
He's just died.
Is that Joe? I didn't even know.
Died past 2 weeks ago.
Not even know that. That's sad. Well, he was great, and at a certain point he said to me, as we sat having tea in the varsity, we were literally sitting after a supervision and sort of chatting about the Bible, and a woman was suddenly over us, who did look like Mary Poppins with a hat and a hat pin, and she said, "Did I hear you talking about the Bible?" And after we'd got rid of her, Derek said, "You know, I don't think it's a terribly good topic. You're asking for trouble." And so I shifted to Sir Francis Bacon, who was one of the team on that King James Bible. And that allowed me to use my history of science. And so I did a dissertation with Robert Bolgar of King's.
Did you? Ah, Robert. What was he like?
Fabulous.
Great scholar, wasn't he?
He was an amazing scholar, but he was extraordinarily accessible, and he was a good left-wing man, and his wife was a JP, and the thing, there was something very grounded about my Cambridge time. I think that's what I'm trying to convey. I mean, I have to confess to you that when I come to Cambridge, I do feel startled by its distance from the hurly-burly of everyday life. Now, I think for undergraduates that's quite good, for some undergraduates. My son had a wonderful time here as an engineer. But I'm saying to you, I needed to be grounded, and it kept me grounded. It was really, you asked me if I liked my school days. I wasn't quite sure, except for the intellectual content. I had the most fantastic time at Cambridge. And it was an apprenticeship in all kinds of things. And some of them I'm using now. The ability confidently to take an adversarial position, to know that if somebody is screaming in your face who is senior to you that you're wrong, if you are careful and coherent, they won't hate you afterwards, whichever of you wins. Really important lesson. A lot of politicians never learn it. Tony Blair never learned it. The confidence that if the argument is being scrupulously conducted and the people are genuinely committed to their cause, then you can shake hands at the end of it. I learned that as a graduate student at Cambridge.
I think, could it be paraphrased by saying that the mind and the heart are separate things, and that you can emotionally keep your calmness while intellectually disagreeing about things?
No, because I get hideously emotional, burst into tears and things. No, I don't. Though it occasionally helps. I think it's... Sometimes I suspected I could have been a good litigation lawyer. People get very affronted when two lawyers stand up in court on either sides of a case, argue hammer and tongs, and then are seen going off to the pub together. People find that almost offensive. It's just that. It's knowing that the that you respect each other for the scrupulousness of the argument, and therefore, and I had lots of occasions of that.
This is supposed to be a deep characteristic of British culture stretching back forever.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, when Fukuzawa came to inspect the West from Japan in the 1870s, mm-hmm. he recounts going to the House of Commons and seeing people saying, "I'll see you hanged and you dog," and so on, and then afterwards seeing them going off arm in arm, and he was quite amazed.
Well, there you are. Well, I learned that that was the case, first as an undergrad, and then graduate, and then as a graduate, and actually in Essex. I mean, the things we did that year to the poor senior staff, you know, and those friendships have survived. And now that I'm chairing a big public body where people hate what we're doing on the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, there are people who hate us for just doing what we do, regulating our assisted reproduction. I have no problem with standing with eye to eye with one of those people and simply saying, "I hear what you're saying, and I take the contrary position, and you're not going to make me change my mind, and I'm quite clear I'm not going to make you change your mind."
Does that calm them down?
I think it probably annoys the hell out of them, but but it's a very useful thing to know that you... And people have said it to me. I mean, people said it to me when I ran a big department in the University of London. They said that it was so... They were all anxious on my behalf, and then they would watch, and it would work, you know. And so, for better or for worse, it's something I quite like to do. And I, as I say, I learned it from those heady political days, which I'm not being sentimental about.
But also from the tutorial system, which is meant to be adversarial.
No.
That's meant to be the basis. You're meant to learn that you can challenge and argue and take contrary views, and then at the end, tutor gives you a
glass. Most supervisors are so lazy; they just get you to read your essay and then make a few comments.
Not me.
No, of course not. Of course not, Alan. Me, but. I can't say I was challenged by teachers. In fact, yes, I had one such teacher at Cambridge in my third year, and that was John Casey of Keyes, who, contrary to what everybody maintained, I mean, you know, it is said he would never teach a woman. Well, he taught me. And I had some of the most, and that was for the Philosophy Moralist paper. And they were the most inspiring supervisions anybody could have. But that was it, really. then my graduate supervisions with Robert Bolger were also challenging. But not in that way of people getting really adversarial.
Were you coming into contact with Kings much then? Because later you had quite an association with it, but...
I married a Kingsman, didn't I?
Yeah, I know.
that was a mistake.
Closer contact.
It was a mistake marrying a Kingsman, right? It wasn't a mistake marrying that man.
No.
It was a mistake marrying a Kingsman.
Why is that?
Well, it's always a mistake for achieving women to marry men who are achieving in the same line of business. Because...
I better mention who this is. This is Nick.
My first husband was Professor Nick Jardine, now he's from Philosophy of Science, who was then a... numerical taxonomist. We met at a party of Graham Mitchison's, the distinguished latterly molecular biologist, very, very quickly married, actually. And we were exact contemporaries, and exact contemporaries in our status. And yet from the day I entered King's, I was treated like the wife. It came between us quite definitely. I then got a job in London at the Warburg Institute. And, you know, at King's, people would say, "Where? Oh, yes, you've got a job somewhere." That's where. Oh. You know, as if it, would it be in hairdressing? I think our marriage probably suffered from that. And then, horror of horrors, his fellowship came to an end, and I got a teaching fellowship in King's. And in its infinite wisdom, the college therefore ruled that he could never dine in college because he was now the spouse of a fellow.
Terence. Well, you say never. I mean, he had to be on special nights.
Yes, right? I know, but he was a fellow in his own right, you know. Mm. When you think back, they were funny old days. Mm. He was furious, and the marriage failed for other reasons, but it didn't really help. So that was really how my association with Kings began.
Mm. But were there people in Kings, since I'm doing a lot of interviews with Kingsmen, were there people in Kings you were, as well as Robert, who you were close to or fond of?
Oh, lots. Mm. Lots. I played table tennis with quite a lot of them. We played table tennis. Ken Moody.
I was going to say, he's a great Kingsman.
Yes. Frank Kermode arrived just about the time I did, and he was a great figure. You know, I did Renaissance, had already moved into Renaissance intellectual history, and, you know, I hugely admired him. But, you know, there was,
Pat Bates.
There was Pat Bates and Martin Rees. I mean, it's terrible. I mean,
Bernard Williams.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, you see, you're prompting me, but if you gave me a list of fellows, no, it was amazing. It was amazing. Being a fellow in my own right was absolutely amazing. I was only here as a fellow for a year.
Hmm.
I had been off to Cornell and held a fellowship there. I came back, got a university lectureship, and I
had been... Which year was this?
1976.
Ah.
I was pregnant with my daughter. I was teaching King's. King's was a little bit sluggish in offering me a fellowship. Mm. And Jesus College, which had been my father's college, wanted to admit its first woman fellow, offered me a fellowship. So I was admitted a fellow of Jesus College on the 6th of November, of December, sorry, 6th of October. 3rd of October, 1976, and owing to a small miscalculation on my part, I was, by my calculation, 9.5 months pregnant, which was very sort of timely because Jesus College had been closed down as a nunnery because the last nun was pregnant, and now their first female fellow was hugely pregnant. But they didn't know I was pregnant, they just thought I was terribly fat. I was admitted a fellow on the 3rd, in chapel, with, you know, the Latin ceremony, standing at the centre of a semicircle, a horseshoe of fellows, and all the way through thinking, please don't let my waters break, please don't let my waters break. And she was actually born on the 6th.
So God heard you.
Yes.
That's a nice story. And you stayed at Jesus for how long?
15 years.
15 years, gosh. Is there anything to say particularly about Jesus?
They were very good to me. It was very complicated being the first woman fellow. It's a huge responsibility. Mm. People were very nice to me, mostly.
Mm.
Mostly. and certainly it didn't bother me, you know. But it was complicated, you know, the responsibility, I mean, of... And then they sort of wanted you to look after the women, and, you know, you did sort of become mummy.
Hmm.
It's very funny, when I was made tutor for women to deal with personal things that they couldn't talk to their male tutors about, the first four people who came to see me were men.
Yes, this was noticed, I mean, in writing about Kings, someone pointed out that women were ascribed to these roles, sort of, maternal roles,
yes,
within the college,
yeah,
at the beginning.
But I, it was a good bit of my career. My marriage broke down in the middle of it, in that wonderful way of Cambridge colleges, everybody behaved as if nothing had happened. So that was very helpful, actually.
Mm.
And, you know, I had a steady job, and I had my children, and I had wonderful students, warring colleagues. I had Howard Erskine Hill and Stephen Heath were my colleagues who couldn't speak to each other, so it put me in another curious maternal role, you know, so, tell Mother that I don't want sugar in my tea. And that, it was quite complicated, but I look back on it as a very nice period of my life, and I'm now an honorary fellow of Jesus, as of King's. But there was a problem in the middle of it, which is probably too much for this, which was that I became politically very heavily involved in the redevelopment of an area of Cambridge known as the Kite, which unfortunately Jesus College owned a £7 million stake in. And actually that was where my adversarial skills and my lack of fear of permanent damage came into their own, and quite realistically so. I mean, I opposed the college. I sat on the bursarial committee, I sat on the college council, and the city council kept asking the college to exclude me from decisions, and they kept saying, the college kept saying, she has a right to know, and she will be bound by confidentiality, which of course I was, and therefore I had to stand in court on two occasions and hear the city solicitor perjure himself under oath. But I was
This is to go on.
I don't care. I really don't mind. I mean, it's just interesting. It is just interesting, you know. Mm. Confidentiality, if you truly observe it, very quickly gets you into situations where you discover other people are being economical with the truth.
Yeah.
So there will be some fellows of Jesus who would characterize me as a thorn in their side, and it is not an accident that I was only made an honorary fellow of Jesus the year before last, whereas I've been an honorary fellow of King's for many years. I didn't know, because it never occurred to me, that I'd been proposed on a number of occasions, and it had not been decided it wasn't suitable.
We've only got about 10 minutes,
yeah.
So can we come back to your work? If you were to pick out...
Hard in 10 minutes.
Sorry?
Hard in 10 minutes.
Well, we might have another go, but for starters, if you were to choose what you think has been your most important contribution intellectually, I mean, which book or that set of ideas you're happiest and proudest about?
My most important book is, without a doubt, Erasmus, Man of Letters, The Construction of Charisma in Print, which is an academic book on Latin texts, but gained the respect of the Erasmus of Rotterdam, the Desiderius Erasmus scholarly community. I mean, there's nothing a young scholar could be prouder of than to write a really controversial book on very difficult material, which makes claims about a great figure manipulating his own writings to create a particular image of himself, and have the grand men of the field welcome you in with open arms. You know, that's the most extraordinary thing, and it's just so... I wish I could do it again.
You will.
And I think beyond that, I've come to feel that I just want to communicate the things that matter in any... And I have no fear of any field, right? I mean, that doesn't make me a dilettante. But I don't think there's any field that I feel I couldn't take on and in 3 months get to grips with enough. I don't mean to make fundamental decisions, but to make it accessible to other people. And that has become a burning desire for me. I mean, you know, we have, as academics, long careers doing fundamental scholarship, and aren't we lucky, you know, fundamental research. I could start another piece of that easily tomorrow. Every time I have a graduate student, I spot something I could easily do. Mm. But given that life is short, the urgent thing for me is to disseminate knowledge as widely as possible. I do believe that were knowledge distributed evenly, more so than money, than wealth, I do believe if knowledge were distributed evenly, there would be less conflict. And that's why I've always been in education, and that's why I'm now in sort of general publishing and broadcasting. I'm a bit bored with general publishing. I think it's about to implode. And I think that there isn't actually a book readership out there for serious books that's under 60. Mm. And the young want other ways of, but then I want to find other ways of getting to them, you know. And I've governed comprehensive schools since 1970, as it were, practically. I've governed state schools since my children were born. And I just know that if you could give all those children a sense of their own worth through knowledge and education, here I am back to, this is Raymond Williams again, they could move confidently into the world. And if they moved confidently into the adult world, we'd stand at least some chance of their not knifing each other on Saturday night, you know.
I missed your second Tanner lecture. Mm. You were presumably talking about this in relation to the internet.
Yes, I was talking about how we have to be courageous about the internet. I actually talked about the history of the book and how the book shared all those features of rapid dissemination, of increasing access, of being subversive, of being polemical, of being uncontrollable, that the internet has. But that I didn't think people mostly were frightened of the book. And that rather than trying to control, but anybody who tried to control the book had failed, actually. Thank God. And so I do feel that, Raymond Williams said that the process of communicating is the process of community. So, and I believe that. So the internet is reshaping the processes of communication, of communicating. I don't care what they're communicating, it's the processes that are changing.
The medium is the message, actually.
It is. And it is, again. I nearly said that yesterday, but I thought people would really think I'd gone back to the ark. And so my plea was that we look at and try to get some sense of the changing shape of communities, which I'm using in a quite old-fashioned social anthropological way, though they won't be geographic or national or even perhaps face-to-face anymore, and try to think through where that might take us in a positive sense, you know. That was about as far as I got, really. I didn't have any answers, but I had some good open questions.
Are you optimistic that the internet and the web will create international communities of this kind?
I mean, I'm a huge optimist, but I'm as optimist as Aldus Manutius was in 1500-something with his multiple copies of Latin texts that were coming off his beautiful printing press, you know. And people around him were saying, oh, it's all going to the dogs, oh my goodness, you know, whatever will happen to scribes, you know, children won't learn proper handwriting anymore. It's all happened before, it's happening incredibly fast. But the democratizing power of the net is so enormous that without romanticizing it in any way, I don't see that we can wish to clamp it down. And Professor Frank Kelly from the Maths Department, as one of the respondents, said, we won't know because actually these things are, they're led by people's desires, you know. Mm-hmm. If people lost interest in the internet tomorrow, it would just die, like so many other things that we've seen rise and fall. So we don't know anything about that. We don't know whether this is a permanent change. Mm. But that was exactly what they said about the book. Mm. Passing fad. Yeah.
We've more or less used all your time up, but is there anything specially that we brushed straight over your work, really, but is there anything else that I really missed that you would have liked to have talked about?
The work I could talk about forever. I think, you know, do you know what? I think one's work is on the record.
That's the
luxury of this kind of face-to-face discussion is that it can supplement the work. And again, that's the mixed media, that's, you know, the power of the modern mixed media. I suppose I would want to put on the record, because of course it's not in any of my books, you know, I had major breast cancer in 2004. Sufficiently severe that I might have died, and in fact would have died but for a Delhi locum in registrar who happened to see the clinic that I regularly went to and saw it. And it's really good to be seriously ill if you're lucky enough to survive it. Because it made me understand a lot more about what I wanted to do. The one thing I did know when I got ill was that I hadn't done what I wanted to do. Now, I still can't tell you what it is, but the sort of commitment to educate and the commitment to disseminate knowledge and to build knowledge and to build in new technology ways that people can access knowledge more easily, they're all part of a sort of group project. It's not my individual identity, it's the group project I'm part of is all the more precious to me, and I think I see it more clearly, and I think that it has been almost a great asset.
To start your life again, you mean?
Yeah. Hmm. It made me much better tempered.
Well, that's a lovely note to end this part of our interview with, anyway. Thank you very much indeed, Lisa.